Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Gruneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Nicole Olver, the SVP of Administration at the Nuclear Company. She's a people-first executive with over 15 years of experience in the strategy, development, and delivery of people and HR departments. Tune in to hear, first, rigor prevents rifts. Thoughtful hiring and clear role definitions protect your team and business from unnecessary layoffs. Second, clarity drives success. When employees understand their role and metrics for success, they perform with purpose and confidence. Third, value over money. Attract talent by articulating the unique value your company offers, beyond just compensation. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Gruneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined by a fellow Australian, Nicole Olver. Nicole's been a CPO at a number of startups and is currently the SVP of administration at the Nuclear Company. So we've been having great conversations about all things startups and clean energy today. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
It's exciting to have you here. And it was cool just reminiscing about old school foods that we grew up with in Australia too.
Korean snacks. There are many a YouTubes of people trying them and not impressed. But look, we have a deep heart for these foods that we are very excited to find in America now. So
yeah, like Tim Tams at Ralph's. That's cool.
Yeah, I get them just at my local the local supermarket at Safeway now. So it's great. Taking over, I think, is the theme here.
I'm all for it. It's David versus Goliath. Perhaps for the benefit of our listeners, Nicole, you could sort of bring them up to speed on your story. How did you come to be doing all this cool work here in the US?
Sure. So born and raised in Australia, spent a lot of time early in my career doing more of the music side of things. So I'm a creative at heart. And then actually came up non-traditionally through an international development background. So it's a very large not-for-profit World Vision that was working out of Australia at the time. Spent a lot of time with them, got to travel around the world. And I say it's really, truly, honestly, the luckiest start in my career was getting to work in that environment because I really got to understand sustainable development and how to go and work with communities and truly build communities that are sustainable, where you can walk away and they self-function. So as someone who then goes into HR, it's an incredible lesson and a really amazing foundation that helped me then think about how to build communities, how to build businesses and things like that. So enter coming to the US, I sort of started my more professional career was riding the tech wave. I came in at a time where the HR space was really transitioning and there was that real tension between what was quite stagnant, old policy, process, structure to this much more modern, like how do we think about humans at the center of the circle as well as customers. You know, how do we make places, workplaces where we think about the employees and what it is to look after them and work with them? So I really got to ride that wave, particularly through the New York tech scene and bounced around a couple of places and a couple of startups and growth companies and did some acquisitions and divestitures and all sorts of fun things. And I say that's like my MBA, like my tech MBA was working with all of these businesses and getting to see the full cycle of business. And then I've really settled in clean energy. I found it's a space that I love. It's a really important space. Climate is going to be an enormous feature of our lives, already is. You know, we're looking at, the scale of hurricanes and things that we're dealing with even today is going to be really important that we solve this crisis, particularly not only just from a weather impact, but also an economic, national security, all of these sorts of things, particularly with the emergence of AI and data farms and things like this, like we need to be thinking about our power source. So clean energy is a natural space for me in that. I love it. I just geek out on the technology and where we're going and, all the conversations and thinking about that space has just been really interesting. So a lot of my more recent history has been in the clean energy space and companies working there.
That's neat. And it is a really cool space to see unfolding because people have traditionally thought of energy, as fairly clunky. It's in many countries it's provided by the government, or it was privatized and is still very, you know, it's utility scale.
Yep.
But we're seeing so many great companies bringing new technologies to bear that maybe changing the way that we generate energy, but they're also definitely changing the way that we use energy and we distribute energy, which has got so much power to bear in communities.
And the exciting thing is everyone's starting to work together. It's not just new tech versus old tech. Like there's this real integration of, if we're really going to solve this, we're going to have to all work together. And I think that's the beautiful moment where we're at a crisis point where we have to, you know? And so I think there's nothing that's off the table. Everyone's kind of coming together and going, here's the little piece that I can contribute and here's the little piece I can give. And so I think it's an exciting time to be working in this space. It's not just, that was old, we don't deal with that anymore. It's like, okay, what of that can we use? What can we, you know, partner with? So yeah, it's been an exciting ride.
That's very cool. And you talked about your time at World Vision, you know, international development, really driving that sustainable development mindset in communities. I read, I think there was an article that you were in on the HR Digest that was talking about when you were there with Inspire Clean Energy, how you sort of tie the people and the business strategy together. I know HR's often been thought of as kind of a support function, but from the way you're describing the story, from what I'm seeing of your approach and approach of other great HR leaders, business strategy and impact outside of the organization is becoming much more core to the role.
It's key, right? And I think that, again, I rode this moment where HR wasn't at the executive table. You know, I'm very lucky I stood on the shoulders of those who really fought to get in that room and earn their spot in that room. And I think that's been the really beautiful part of the evolution of what we see as modern HR leaders, is that we are in the C-suite, we are at the table, and we're there helping drive the business strategy. And we're going, we're pushing these teams to give us their 3 to 5 year plans. Why? So we can then pare it down and make it really clear to everyone, here's the goals for what that means for your department. Now let's break that down to those individual goals. Why do we need that? It's so that every single person that comes into the business is super clear on how they're going to do the job they need to do, how they're going to be measured on it, how they're going to feel really good about it. If you can get that down to that individual level, that everyone feels bought in from the moment that they start, that is the key to the success, not only of your business, but also your employees and their longevity and their growth, and all of those things matter. So it really starts with having HR leaders coming in and driving and pushing for that. Now, that traditionally used to sit with probably your CEOs and your COOs and things like that, but honestly, they're busy. Like there's a lot going on. So I'm seeing those kind of roles now start to fall to the HR leaders, which I think is really exciting, because then I build my strategy and the people strategy based off matching and really honing in on what the business and the company trajectory is. It all then aligns. Everything is now related versus having these like very strange silos where these teams are just kind of going off and doing the things you're meant to do in these teams, but they're just all clunky and they create so much duplicative work and it's just inefficient. So I've seen by the emergence of that and really like championing that role and championing that strategy, companies are performing and outperforming their competitors by doing so.
Yeah, I like the way you kind of framed it as clarity around what the role is and then measurement of like how they're performing in the role.
Yeah.
I think that's something that we can perhaps be a bit complacent in as leaders in businesses. We're like, oh, well, everything's changing all of the time and you just got to be really agile when you're around here and, you know, find a way to make it work. But that actually doesn't work for a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I was talking to a friend today who's starting her business and she said, I've got my first hire. Like, can you help me with a job description? And I was going through it with her and I said, look, you're missing one very key thing to me that is the make or break of this role. And she's like, what? I'm like, literally a section that says, these are the first year deliverables and here's the KPIs that are going to be associated with that.
Yeah.
And it was like this like light bulb went off in her brain. And I was like, this is all that matters. Like if you give this when you are giving your offer letter, I come in as the employee. I'm really clear on how to hit the ground running. I know exactly how I'm going to be successful. I know exactly what I'm going to have to deliver. It means that when I'm asked, you know, when a hiring manager is asking me to hire someone, they're really clear on what they're looking for. They know exactly how they're going to measure success. Because if you look at like, I mean, I have been a part of a lot of reductions in force and having to run them. And it's because we weren't doing these steps at the beginning. Mm. We just sort of said, I need this hire. This person's asked me for this hire and I just hired them and then they need a team. And it really just didn't have a lot of the rigor that we now need because we're so tired of having to constantly do these reductions in force. So how do you get ahead of it? Well, you learn from it. You know, you think about these things and go, well, let's be really thoughtful about how we hire.
Yeah.
And let's make sure that we're really setting everyone up for success. And we need these roles and we know how to measure for them.
Yeah, I like that. I really like that call out on rigor preventing riffs. I think there's something there.
It's, I mean, perfect alliteration, if nothing else. But honestly, like it's hard work for us. Like none of us want to come in and do that. But you're sort of cleaning up what has been, it's never malicious, right? Like I've watched and I've been a part of so many companies that are growing and they're growing fast and everyone's just got to go and everything needed to be done yesterday. I think that's a little bit of the New Yorker in me, but and it's not malicious, but we just get really too excited is probably the best way to put it. And you're just growing and everything feels great and you just keep wanting to add more people because that means the company's doing well. But there is a beauty in discipline that I think we've always seen as like, oh, discipline's the worst. But that rigor is actually a really beautiful thing because now you're protecting your people, you're protecting your asset, you're protecting your investment, and how you do it is so thoughtful. And it doesn't slow you down. In fact, it speeds you up because you know exactly what you're looking for. You know exactly how everyone's going to be measured. It's not frustrating as an employee coming in because the worst thing is coming in and having no idea how to be successful or how you're going to be measured. So if all of that's clear from the minute you walk in the door, even if it's complete chaos and everyone's building in real time and it's crazy, you've got an anchor. You know exactly how to weather that because you know what you've got to come in and do. And I think that is the big difference. And it's just a simple tweak to a job description. It's really not much, but that key can be the huge difference of what can happen later down the road.
Yeah, there's a book behind me on systems leadership that a good friend, Ian McDonald, wrote. And he did a lot of work actually with my old man in the mining industry in Australia back in the 80s and 90s. And back at that time, you know, workforces were heavily demarcated and unionized and everything else, but they really got focused on role purpose. And they were like, well, if everyone has a singular sentence of role purpose, like this is what I'm here to do for the company, then they know what their job is. But equally importantly, other team members know what their job is and how to support it. So it creates a lot more connective tissue in the business. And people actually know how to be better team members, not just individual contributors.
And I'd say, honestly, one of the most important things you can come in and do as a leader too is get it done at the executive level. Having really clear swim lanes. Who's responsible for what? Because I can promise you I've sat in enough meetings where it's like, no, wait, that's what I do. Like, no, that's what I've been doing. And you're just sitting there going, oh, God, I can see all of this unfolding right now in real time. We've got two teams who've gone off and done individual things and it just wasn't clear. Like this happens all the time. And so I think if you're coming in early, again, I normally come in at earlier stages of companies, really clear swim lanes, who's responsible for what. And then as you grow, you keep assessing, you keep looking at this and re-challenging it and going, does this still make sense to sit with you? Should we move it over here? But if it's clear there, it's going to cascade down.
Yeah.
Often what I'll see is it can get really clear at the lower ranks and the lower levels. And then at that higher point, it's just murky because no one's taken the time or they haven't as a team taken the time to really do that work. It's make or break, particularly when companies are younger or in their early stages of funding. Like that is the make or break of how you can really save yourself the riffs later.
Yeah, I love that call out on top down, Nicole, because to your point, often a leader comes into the business and the easiest place to start is, hey, go through the ground floor and work your way up because those tasks are more granular. We understand them more.
Exactly.
But it misses the point on some of the bigger work streams and ways of working in the business. I know pre-show you and I were talking about we're now living in this place kind of between sort of no longer and not yet. We've still got to work out what our working practices are. And actually so much more of that now is going to come from the executive teams and it's going to have to cascade, as you say.
Yep. And a little bit up too, right? You've got a younger generation coming into the workforce. They have very different ideas of how work is done and all of these things. And I see, you know, I see a lot of the articles. It's, you know, it's sort of like, if this happened to me, right? I'm a millennial. And it was like, the millennials are here and they're the worst workforce of all time. And now it's like, we're emerging. And they're like, actually, they weren't that bad. It's like, it was just different, right? It's sort of like the same thing you're seeing now. All the articles are like, Gen Z is the worst generation. I'm like, look, we can't keep doing this every time there's a new emergence of young people, right? It is different. The workplaces are different. You've got older generations that are looking at younger going, I can't believe like this, how much has changed, but that doesn't mean we repel it. it means we come to the table and go, hey, this is really different. Like, where's the bridge? Here's what I grew up in. Here's what you're coming into. And this is just the like opposite ends of the spectrum. Where do we meet? What does this become? And sit with that tension and that, you know, that element of like, what do we learn from each other versus the just straight rejection of, right? Because that's what creates the problem. And then in years' time, there's going to be articles written like, oh, Gen Z was the greatest generation. You know, like it's just,
they were the game changers.
Yeah, yeah. But it's just an interesting tension. I don't know. I don't know what you're seeing in terms of leaders and talking about this topic, but I just find it really interesting.
I mean, it's a good question. I'm personally experiencing the opportunity to socialize a whole lot more as a leader than perhaps I did 10 years ago or 20 years ago that my leaders socialized with me. Yep. So there's an opportunity to kind of lean into that intergenerational difference or technology difference, because a lot of there's a lot of people in some businesses that are very technology forward and there's some that aren't technology forward. So I think the opportunity to invite others into the conversation and maybe be more intentional about crafting role designs or strategic initiatives is kind of cool now. And I think asynchronous technology offerings, like being able to put something in SharePoint or out on Teams and have multiple people comment, has helped a lot in that setting. But I'm not seeing it in startups. I haven't really worked in closely with startups. So I would imagine it's probably even on the next level, given
it is
their agile practices.
Exactly. Everything's agile. And I think, look, most of my working career was in an office. And then you had this moment in COVID where everyone suddenly was work from home and companies were not ready for it. I mean, there were companies that literally just went offline because they didn't have ways for their people to meet. Especially in these big, big organizations, right? The littler ones were easier. They were agile. They could make those pivots, not easily, but faster. And then it took the companies a lot longer to really make those transitions. But I think, you know, you can kind of look at any moments in history. That was a weird time to be a human, right? Like that was on no one's bingo card to like, oh, we'll live through a pandemic and like experience all that that was, right? I think many of us have blocked it out just for like sheer survival reasons. I had two little kids trying to work from home. That was a whole situation. But I think there's also a little moment where you can go, what did we learn? Was there something that like the curtain kind of got lifted and the fog cleared and we could see, why are we doing what we do? We had this moment of being able to go into this deep, like reflection and inquisition as to like, why do we work like that? Have we challenged that? Have we thought about that? You know,
but
you get these moments in time. The last time that probably happened was like the Industrial Revolution, right? Like in terms of how workers worked and all the rest. And I think the really interesting tension now is coming out of it. And you're seeing this real shift of people trying to go back to what they knew, because that's all they knew. And like, let's go back. And then you're seeing this emergence of like, no, we learn a lot. And there's some really interesting lessons of how we got work done and, you know, what that meant and the accessibility for people and what that meant in terms of being able to work and not having to live in cities and live in tiny apartments and houses we can't afford and, you know, different communities and what that meant for micro communities. And there was all this interesting stuff that happened that I think now is the tension we're playing with, because you've got this real shift and pull from the old, but then you've got this real, we learned something and let's kind of grow and learn and integrate that, right? It comes back to that. Do we just lock into what was, or do we invite the newness to the table and sit with it and play with it and kind of work out what that means for us? So I'm excited. I know a lot of people freak out in this tension, but this is the part that I love the most. And it's probably why I love startups, because it's itchy and it's uncomfortable. And we're going to have to really challenge and look at ourselves and make some hard decisions and try some things and fail and like learn from it. And I think that's where it gets really exciting to me.
I think it does. I was just at lunch today with a good friend, John Roachford, and he came out of the construction industry and he described COVID as like a crucible moment. He was just like, here we are, we're in the construction industry, so we can't all go remote. We've still got work sites to run and, you know, buildings to put together. And he was like, we took it as a moment to really change the way we're working as an executive team. So at that time, he started a transition out of the CEO role and, you know, was moving the president up into that capacity. And it was just a really cool story to say, hey, when it is uncomfortable, when there is tension, it can be a bit of a forcing function.
Yeah, to make those decisions and to think about it. But I honestly think it's the only way we're going to evolve. Like as humans, yeah. I mean, all of this technology is coming at us. Everyone's like, what? Everyone's just using the term like, oh, it's got AI. Like it's like, that seems to mean some magical thing, like you'll understand. Like, but no one really knows what that means, how that's going to integrate, what that means for jobs. Like this is all going to be real time. And it's the acceleration and the speed at which this change is coming is huge. Like the way people are having to write ChatGPT policies at work, you know, like not things that people were thinking about or looking at as part of what would be in the next year, but the technology is moving very quickly. So we're going to have to get comfortable with uncomfortable, and it's going to be us and on us as leaders to really drive that sitting in the discomfort and really, you know, not being rigid. And the people who've been practicing growth mindset and organizations that have been really trying to curate that are going to
Yep.
do very well in this. But those that are just, again, locked into the old, really not evolving with the new, are going to really struggle. And you'll see it. It's not going to just affect the people and the company. It's going to affect their results and their profits and all of it. So it's the butterfly effect of this is going to be huge.
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of talent's going to vote in that direction with their feet, right? A lot of talent's going to go towards businesses that are being more pioneering or being more open-minded about how they invite people in to shape the way they do their work.
Yep. And well, I mean, it's interesting, the framing, right? You look at Amazon, who've just done the return to 5 days in the office. And for people on the inside, I live in Seattle, so I have a lot of friends who work there, and they're like, this is just another reduction in force without having to do it.
Yeah.
It's like people are going to vote with their feet. And the tension that they're going to play with in that is that they actually lose their best people, because their best people have choice and can go and work in other places and kind of, you know, make those terms. So yes, you may lose 20% of the workforce, which is probably what they're going for, but you may lose all the people that you actually need the most. And then you're trying to pull them back with more money or, you know, counter offering or whatever it is you're trying to do that. You may end up paying more. Like it's a gamble. We'll see how it plays out, but it's a really uncomfortable way to get the same result. But I suppose if the PR works, the PR works, right?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think you're right on the adverse selection, that you'll have some of the people left behind that you would have preferred to have gone. At the same time, there's something to be said for, maybe not in the Amazon example, but companies that know that the way that they're going to work is in person and that they just stayed it out, then they're going to go through a moment of pain, maybe it's short-term pain, long-term gain, but then they're going to get a collective of people who actually love to work together and do so because there's important things that they do there, not just because it's where their computer and terminals are situated.
That's so interesting. I was talking to someone who, you know, would be in the Gen Z crowd, and they sort of said, look, I'm kind of tired working from home. Like I've moved to a new city. I don't, you know, you all met friends through work. You know, I don't have socialization. Like we do these sort of virtual things and that's fun for a couple of years, but like, I just want to sit in and meet people and go for after work drinks and like, you know, be a part and sit in and learn from my leaders. And so there is still this hunger, I think, from those that, again, I speak from the position of having most of my career in the office. I got that, right? So I can now play both sides of what that is and, you know, get the benefit of both. But if you're just starting out, you missed a whole chunk of learning that was happening just by osmosis and being in those spaces and things like that. So I think the call out for that is, if, you know, you've got this group who are going back to office and the work needs to be done and that's going to solve itself through that. But then if you are in a remote situation, you really have to create those moments. And there is that very intentional of how do we come together and what does that look like? And, you know, all of those pieces that are going to be absolutely pivotal if you are hiring, especially much younger employees or people that need that connection.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. It actually reminds me of, I don't know if you saw the video recently on LinkedIn. It was the character Brian Cox, who plays Logan Roy in Succession. Mm-hmm. And he's doing this, the video of like, people needing to come back to the office because it's unhealthy to sit at home.
Well, he was.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
I'm gonna have to look it up now. I haven't seen it.
And it was very much about like, hey, come back to the office, but keep active, keep getting out and walking. And it was a feisty commentary.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, but there is going to be a lot of change that comes as you dive into the AI space, Nicole. When we're thinking about ways of working, creating clarity in roles, creating measurement, I'm seeing from a lot of guests on the show that they're all advocating for writing down the way that we work, being more documented, not to the granular level of, mm-hmm. you know, a desk operating procedure for this is how you do the task, but this is how we do tasks and what cadence, this is how we do meetings, such that, you know, you can go back and you can challenge and change it, which you can't do with unwritten ways exactly. of working.
Yep.
Are you seeing much in your space around that? And have you got a view on how AI may actually come in and be sort of a coach on the shoulder and start almost informing us of ways that are organically happening, ways of working that are organically happening, teams?
I'd say that I wouldn't say it's a hot topic of conversation amongst peers. What I would say is I've seen, particularly maybe my bias is that I've worked in a lot of tech companies, right? And so I think that's just been table stakes for a long time within tech companies because yep. of the way in which they've wanted to disrupt how work gets done. So mm-hmm. they're highly aware that if you're going to disrupt it, then you've got to make it really, really clear what the parameters are. And, you know, coming from a sort of more structured HR, you know, world and then going into this sort of emergence of a more modern, I always say to people, like, I'm here to just put the scaffolding up and then you guys play and like be as free as you want. But here's the parameters, right? Like, here's the parameters of how we meet, what that looks like. But then you want to give freedom. You know, you need to give people yeah. the ability to be creative and play within that. You don't want to be too prescriptive where it's yeah. like this, because again, that just makes everyone feel really confined and actually has the adverse effect to what you're looking for. But if you're like, here's the scaffolding. And, you know, a lot of employee handbooks do this now where they talk about the ways of working and, you know, they put a lot of this online and everyone can access it from anywhere. You know, it's not just like just for the internal use only. And it's really kind of a mud map of how to have fun at a company and do cool yeah. work and meet together. And this is what we do. And, you know, it doesn't have to be hyper prescriptive, but it's at least something that gives that sort of ability to work out how to be successful and how to work like this. So I think for me, I'm acknowledge my bias because I think it has been the table stakes of coming in and as an HR leader, having to co-build a lot of these things and make sure that those environments are there. But I think for companies that haven't done it or have been too prescriptive, they're going to have to work out what that formula is for the business. And I always say, like, coming in as an HR leader, I don't come in and just give the playbook. Like, it's yeah. very bespoke. I work very much with the culture that exists, what is already happening, because it's no point working and trying to buck against it, right? There's already a culture that's going on.
Yeah.
Now, you may need to tweak some things. There might be some things you lovingly need to redirect, but for the most part, it's already going on. So it's just about going, let's document this. Do we like it? Do we agree as a collective? Maybe we need to change it, or are we good? Mm-hmm. Great. Let's just put it down and make it clear to everyone so that when you come in, much like with the job description, it's really clear how to get work done, how to communicate well. You know, I know a lot of leaders, when you meet with a new employee, the first thing you go is like, here's what it's like. Here's how working with me. I'm a texter. Do you know, do this. Don't ever message me on that system. I never check it. Like, mm-hmm. kind of have your list of like how to get, you know, your work done together. And you do the same back and forth. Like, how do you like to be communicated with? Like, you kind of work out how we're best going to work. I think it's just doing that at the company level of like, how will you get your work done? Here's what the norms are. And then refresh them, right? Like, if you're a Series A, it's not going to be the same when you're a Series B. You're going to have a lot more people. You may need some processes that you might have
thought, yeah.
oh, we're not big enough for that. Maybe you do now, right? So you have to keep having these little moments of check-in where you go, do these still make sense? Is this like these kind of ways of working? Are they actually working? You know, if people are going back to the office now, you might have had a whole lot of stuff for async work that no longer is there, or maybe there's still some, maybe we should play with that a bit more and keep it integrated. So
yeah.
I think that each company is going to have to work that out for themselves. There are a lot of amazing online resources and a lot of, you know, playbooks that people have just put, companies just put out there that you can have access to. But I think for the most part, it really is an individual exercise.
Yeah. Well, if you go about that, let's say one of our listeners out there today is a smaller business.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the HR function role to go and capture those ways of working? Do you make it more sort of democratic and you ask different people to fill out templates? Like, where would you start as a leader that hasn't got many of their ways of working written down?
Depends on the size of the business. If you're small yeah. and it's really just a couple of you, I would say do it as a team. Like, sit down yeah. with your executive team. If you're a really small company, like sub 15 people, you could probably even do it as a company and just, you know, come together and go, okay, how do we want to meet? What do meetings look like? How do we communicate? Do we have some parameters around that? Like, what are the kind of guardrails of how we do some of the basics and the basic fundamentals? If you're a larger company, you don't want to be too democratic. You can have input, but like, it can get really slow, really fast if you give everyone the ability, you know, to kind of have, you know, create policy at that level. I think you create a group, and that it doesn't have to just be the executive team every time. It could be like a little task force of multiple, you know, people from different parts of the organization coming together and go, you know, I love working with people who helped build the companies, you know, when I come in, because I'm like, you're like the OGs. What was the culture? What's the real heartbeat of this business that I need to protect? And what are the things about this company that you would just be devastated to see change? Because there is an essence within every business. And that's the part that's really sacred you've got to hold to. So my people who've been there for a really long time, I always pull them into the room, even if they're not executive team, because they have a richness and this like essence of learning that I can extract a lot from and really, again, protect and kind of make sure is embedded into what is going to be the new. So I think having a little task force that are a part of that is a way to make sure that you have representation as well across the business. And it isn't just executives living in their little world and, you know, seeing one perspective, maybe missing a whole lot of things at how the work actually gets done, that those decisions have had the right people in the room to help make them.
I really like that task force model.
It does maybe work. I've seen it a few times where you pull, and people love it. Like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, there's this whole like, oh, I don't want to have to do extra work. But I'm like, people who have built these businesses up, they love to be a part of seeing it thrive and being a part of like being in the room and being like, this isn't important. This is probably one of the most important things we can do as a business is work out what are the key ingredients that we need to protect and how we want to work. And, you know, those things are really, really important.
Definitely. And that inclusion of the founder or some of the early team members is cool too, because I've seen a lot of teams like, well, that's the old way, so let's not invite them into the room. Let's design the way it should work now with what we know. But it needs to be a blend of the both.
And again, bring in some of the younger ones, the people who've just started, younger employees straight out of college. I mean, they see the world differently, and it's not bad. It's different. And I think sometimes having that voice in there can really help you evolve, right? It's sort of like when you need multi-generation in life, right? You need your elders, you need the young ones, all of it matters. Like, I think we kind of have come into a point where we just stick with our own, and like that can be ages, that can be like people who agree with us, whatever that means, but that's not serving us, it's not helping us, it's creating the dissension, right? So if we can kind of apply the models of like multi-generational approach to workplaces, to all of these sorts of things, we hire for it, right? We know the value of diverse viewpoints and all of those perspectives, it's a richness. But then we have to take that to the policy level. We have to take that in how we build our businesses and kind of integrate all the way through. That's how you create the change, right? It has to all be working together.
Oh, I agree. The other call out that I've seen some teams do really well on here is leaning into neurodiversity as well. So, you know, you get people to process in very different ways and get them to look at systems. We had one guest on and she shared with us that it was really cool to do ride-along days, where you would have a colleague go with a team member and they would just see what systems they were using, tools they were using, and they would just respond, hey, that's awesome that you do it that way. I'm going to take that back to my team. Or I can't believe it takes you 8 steps to enter that data into this system. Like, surely there's a better way than this. Yep. You need to go and speak to Bob or Jenny or Imran or whoever it is.
And I think a lot of companies try and do this as part of onboarding, right? Like when I came in to my previous company, we had a call center that we would work with. And one of the tasks of my onboarding week was to go and sit off for a couple hours on the call center and just listen to our people talk to customers all day. And we actually kept it as a program. So when you completed onboarding, every 6 months, you'd kind of do it again as a refresher. And
it
was so unbelievably helpful, not only for the fact that you should be always close to your customers in terms of regardless of the work you do, you need to be hearing from the people you're serving, but it also just made you appreciate and see the work in action, but also realize where your part of the pie could have some correction, right? Like, oh, am I contributing to this? Have I made this harder because of that decision that I thought was great? But then what does it actually mean over here? Like, and again, you know, people spending time across the lines with the other parts of the organization, it really helps those ride-along days, like actually going and seeing the work in action. Like, remember the show Undercover Boss? Like, it was like, that was such a revolutionary idea to go and spend time in your business. Like, but it's sort of, I think now we need that again to get, you know, the correct innovation and, you know, to see what those decisions look like at the ground level and what it looks like for people having to do them. It's so much harder in big companies, like moving those big policy decisions. It's really hard. Like, you just get really big and all the rest. But when you're smaller, again, capturing some of those parts that it's part of onboarding, but it's a continuation of onboarding. Like it's not just first 3 months and then we're done. Like how does this integrate so it becomes part of the culture versus just the learning?
I think to your point on big companies finding it hard to move, I think that's why we've seen so much positive disruption come from startups, because they're not carrying that sort of inertia, that policy heaviness, and people can just come in and start re-breaking things down and building them in better ways without stepping on toes or having to go through multiple levels of approval.
And it's also, I mean, you see it, the companies that are really big but still have like sort of like little micro businesses within them where they still function like little startups, they have the ability to pivot and move quite quickly as well. And I think that's a really interesting and a more revolutionary approach to doing so is they create and they keep that nimbleness, right? Versus just going, all HR is now distributed in here and you never see the people that you serve. Like it's like it all becomes its own company, but as a team, that's where I think it can get a little dangerous.
Definitely. Switching gears, OKRs. Mm-hmm. I've never liked them. I know a lot of people coming out of the tech world talk about them a lot.
All of the time.
What is it that I'm missing? What's your experience been with OKRs and how that ties into some of this clarity and sort of written measurement and procedure?
It can work, but everyone has to do it. And that's my problem, right? Like as someone who has been a part of so many iterations of the OKR process, you know, it's normally a founder who's really excited by it or a CEO is like, I really want to do OKRs. I read a book about it or I read this article and we've now got to do OKRs. And you're like, okay, great. And then, you know, you have that resistance and then you have half the people who are bought in and who actually fill it out and use the technology and however you integrate it into your systems. And then you have those that don't, right? So it's only as good as if everyone's bought into doing it. Now, if I come back to my very original point where we started, which is where HR has a really interesting seat at the table, OKRs is really just structuring exactly what I said. It's starting with like, what is the company goals? How do we then break that down to its smallest part so that you as the individual are really clear on like, what are your three initiatives that you're working on and all the rest, right? But what I will say, and the big distinction of where I've seen this actually work, and I did this with my team at my previous company, is one of those OKRs should just be getting the job done. So it sounds so simple, but honestly, you see your whole team take a collective breath when they realize, oh, I'm going to be measured on the work that I'm supposed to be doing.
Yes.
Like one goal should always just be, what are we doing to keep the trains on the track, right? The second one should be, okay, what are we doing to iterate or like maybe shift something that needs some correction? And then the third one should be, what's something net new and big and bold and crazy that we could go for, right? The problem I have seen where I've seen OKRs fail is that everyone's using that last piece. And I think the true essence of OKRs is to go for the bold, crazy, but all of them should be that. And then everyone's just defeated because they never hit the goals. They feel so aspirational and out of reach that everyone's just like, calls BS on us. Like, this isn't actually going to happen. We're not actually going to hit these goals. And then the whole thing falls apart anyway, right? Because you don't have any buy-on. But I think the structure of it can work. I think it's just the reality that you then insert into what those goals are. But I'd be curious. I don't know. Does that settle some tension? Does that feel palatable? Does it still give you an allergic reaction?
What really helps with your approach, Nicole, is that kind of, I know HBR put that three box model out there too. The fact that you said day job, that's probably the most relieving thing.
Yep.
And then you said iterative goal and then you said big shift.
Yep.
For me, that feels right. I think my experience with OKRs, even having failed at deploying them myself, is that whole eyes are bigger than the stomach. Well, we're going to go and do these five things, which are going to cascade down into 25 things across these 5 leaders, which is now going to cascade down to 75 things across this team.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my gosh, we've just created a beast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, it can be demotivating, right? A lot of people's bonuses and company bonuses are tied on these things. And if you've been way too aspirational, it actually then people don't get their bonuses. Like it's gonna pollute the process anyway, because what are they gonna, what's human behavior gonna do the next time? If you've attributed particularly monetary value toward it, they're going to go, how do I hack this system to get the most monetary value out of it, right?
Yes.
It's human psychology. So understand that, work with that and go, okay, like the model I just spoke about, that seems doable. You went, I could do that. And I'm excited and motivated to do that, which means you'll probably outperform it just by the nature of being engaged with it and excited by it, because you can actually feel like you can achieve it. But there's still something there that's like, let's go to be crazy. Let's go do something really cool and different. It's still there. The company will still have innovation. But I think it speaks to this fact of like over indexing on hypergrowth, right? You know, the whole collective economy was on this grow, 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 grow at all costs, grow at all costs. And it doesn't work like that. There's no part of nature that can just grow all the time. It's just against everything that is normal. So it doesn't work. So you have to be the realism, I think, is now starting to get baked in, which I'm here for. I think it's, I want people too. Excited and feel like they can actually do something and be really excited. So they want to then go do more. Like that feels attainable.
It does. And you're right on like the whole zero interest rate period that we live through. People could just throw money, like brute force their way through, you know, certain innovations or new product launches. And it just felt like a lot of people got ground out, burnt out.
Yep.
It wasn't working. So I'm hoping that if people can be more real and sort of now in the way that they do work, then teams are going to have that satisfaction of getting their jobs done, but also that little bit of room, like you touch on, to go and do the next step stuff.
Now, the key is for us that have lived through this to remember this and put all the brakes on in a few years' time when everyone's like, grow at all costs. This sounds like a great model. We haven't tried this before, right?
Yeah.
We have to be the ones leading the charge that go, wait. We've lived this. This is what the outcome of that is. And again, just being that little bit of realism in the room of like, how do we actually do this sustainably is the key, right? It was just so unhealthy in the way in which this was done. And the results of that were catastrophic. I mean, the job losses have just been wild. So we need to be really thoughtful and apply that lessons learned, take that history with us and go, right, let's do better. Let's be better. Let's have that rigor. Let's have some discipline, not being bad discipline, good discipline, and actually build better businesses because of it.
Yeah, I'm all for that. I'm jumping on that train.
Yeah.
I've got one last question for you, and it actually ties to compensation. I was sitting with the startup owner last week, and we're talking about how awesome this whole Gen Z movement is. Mm-hmm. He was saying, well, here's my problem. I'm bringing these really good engineers in, but they're not interested in the stock options. They want to get paid well, and they want to have good lifestyles. And he's just like, we're a startup. Like, you come here to work really hard, achieve amazing things, and maybe you have a big wealth generating event from having got there. What's your view on like how we might need to be resetting the whole total rewards compensation model for this new generation and being more real and being more now and present in our thinking?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting one. This I've seen a lot more conversation about, you know, what does total rewards look like and what is, you know, your EVP of the company and what does that look like? I think compensation should really be the last part of the conversation you're having as a company. If you're leading with compensation, you're already lost, right? Like, I think it's sort of like, you need to set up, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. Here's what you would be doing. Here's the work. Here's the things that we can offer. Oh, and by the way, here's what we pay, right? The pay is sort of the like cherry on top, but you've got to establish the why and like what it is the work you will be doing. I mean, I've taken a title cut. I've taken a pay cut many times in my career, not because I want to. I mean, I always love to earn more money, but because the business or what I was going to be doing or who I was going to be working with was so compelling that I could make that distinction and I could go, you know what? I see the value and I can see that if I do this now, it's going to grow. And it has paid off every time. The decision was for the right reasons, but it was positioned to me in the right way in terms of what was interesting to me. And I think we need to understand, and companies need to take the time to understand what is it that they are offering. And that total rewards isn't just a compensation. It isn't just your base pay. You know, is remote work going to be one of those pieces that feel like compensation now? Is the, you know, here's all the additional things that you can have in terms of how you will get your work done, or here's what we offer additionally to compensation that become part of it. I hear you on the equity, and I'm a generation that got a lot of equity that hasn't gone a lot of places, right? For a lot of people, it's felt like magic beans. And I was promised the world. I was given a graph with 10x of value that I was going to see. Haven't seen any of it, right? You know, just for context, I was one of the WeWork companies. So, you know, definitely some underwater that happened there. Now, I still think if you are a company with equity, I still think there's there's something exciting about that. And I say to people, like, it's still part of compensation. There is still an element where this could be something. We can't guarantee it will be, but if you like that risk and you're coming from a company where you haven't had it, it's a little bit of fun. Like, let's see, let's go and build something incredible and see if we can get, you know, enormous value from there. But I hear the sentiment of it doesn't mean as much to me anymore and I just want to live a great life and all the rest. They also may not be your people. The amount of times I have hired for these companies and they're like, I want this unicorn person. I'm like, they've got a package on the table that they're not going to walk away from. Like, you may have to change your expectations. There's a lot of people out there who are undertitled, have been doing incredible work for a long time. Just think differently about how you actually hire at the front end. You know, you can't afford them. Doesn't matter. There's someone who's there, who's hungry, who's just waiting for that opportunity and will find your business and what you're doing compelling, right? So I think companies, my advice would be spend the time to work out what it is you're offering as a business and don't lead with the comp because then you've already lost, right? You know, everyone, the amount of surveys I have done in businesses of what, you know, what you're unhappy with, and everyone says comp. I'm like, of course, everyone wants to be paid more. Like, that would be amazing. But, you know, what are the other elements in terms of, you know, how we get our work done and, you know, all the things that are there. But I don't know if you've heard different things, seeing different things.
I like your view. I particularly like the way you're saying find your people. Like, there are other people out there who are going to be excited about the way that you work. I think for any business, small or large, that's an exciting prospect.
Yeah. And we're at an interesting point in the market. There is not a lot of mobility right now. There's not a lot of jobs. So for companies that have worked out how to position themselves, people are sitting in roles they don't want to be in. They're deeply unhappy. Maybe they are being pulled in back into or being asked to do a work situation they don't want to do anymore.
Yeah.
There are people really, there are a lot of job seekers right now. They're just not moving. So again, if you can be compelling enough in how you're positioning and what you can offer and some of the flexibility you can offer. I mean, I think those that are say, how do you want to work? Come work with us and we'll work it out. You know, like, they're going to get some incredible talent because they're offering choice, right? I think that will be the bigger ticket than it will be than compensation these days.
I agree.
Particularly for people who've worked, you know, in lots of different ways and, you know, for different companies. So I think that is, you know, those that are like, you don't have to come into the office 5 days a week will actually be the biggest ticket you can offer someone in terms of attracting good talent. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting couple of years, I think, to watch.
I think so. The one that I'm still hoping on is a bit of an outside bet is that company-provided housing makes a comeback because we're living through this housing crisis. It's so expensive, particularly in some of our higher demand cities, that if a company is really meaning to do great work and they want their people to be in the office, then maybe providing housing is going to be a big shift. I mean, it can sit on their balance sheet. It doesn't have to be, it can be a company asset, but I think for certain people, they're going to say, well, I don't have to sell my house or I don't have to buy a house. I can go and live in this place and do great work. I'm intrigued by that, having seen it in other markets, including, you know, in Midland, Texas, in the oil boom, when they were providing McDonald's workers with apartments just to get McDonald's workers into town. Like it happens in extreme moments. So
my only challenge and the part that goes for me is then what happens when they lose the job?
Yeah.
Right? That to me, and because I think there's a bit of that, what is the employee loyalty aspect now? Like, I think if you look at that model when it worked, you knew you were going to have that job for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
It was like a loyalty contract of like, we're going to give you this accommodation or come work with us and you'll be with us for years. I don't think companies can offer that anymore. And I think the last have ripped up that sort of indirect contract a little bit. So the only part, it's a bit like me, like healthcare, right? You lose your job, you lose your healthcare. Imagine losing your healthcare and your housing. Like, I mean, that's a pretty dramatic, like losing a job in that moment when everything's associated to it, that are your like true Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yep.
I don't know. Maybe for me,
that's a good challenge. No, that's a great challenge.
Healthy distinction might be safer for just people's mental health. Like, I just think you couldn't come back from like losing a job where everything was on the stakes of that.
Yeah, you don't want indentured, you know, service people staying because they can't leave. That goes back to your point earlier on the Amazon RTO.
I like where you're going. I see you what you're trying to solve for though, right? Like housing and prices, and if you're trying to pull people back into cities and they're expensive, like how do you solve for that?
Yeah.
I think it's like maybe the solution is that like that governmental, you know, sort of like housing conversation.
Yeah, affordable housing and
Like how that maybe that's more, maybe that's where it should sit with the policy level versus the company. Because we have tried to make companies solve for policy.
Yes.
Incorrect policies, right? At a governmental level. I don't think that always works. I think there is this place for where government should intervene and then where companies should. I don't think companies should keep solving for all of those downfalls. I think it's a tension, and I'm happy to sit on the debate of it because I actually think it's a really excellent thought exercise of playing with what that is. I just worry again, maybe it's because I'm fresh from a lot of reductions in force. I'm like, oh my God, imagine having to tell someone they've lost their house, their healthcare, you know, like it's that's rough. Just a horrific moment.
Yeah, it is. No, that's a good call out. Well, it's been a great conversation, Nicole. I think starting at the very top, we talked a lot about the proximity of modern HR model, modern people functions to strategy and business strategy. I love the way you dived into the clarity and the measurement of roles, and how I love that rigor stops riffs as well. That was a great soundbite. That was super.
We can get some
cool
t-shirts, maybe.
That's it. Yeah, we should send those out. The documenting the ways of working, leaning into AI, that concept of scaffolding and creating enough structure but allowing people to play, I thought was brilliant. So many good ways to let the teams really determine who they are and how they're going to work. And then going back to this last part of the conversation around compensation, how to attract their people.
Yeah.
That ties heavily into sustainability in so many different ways. So I really enjoyed the conversation at large. If any of our listeners want to kind of reach out and connect with you, where's the best place for them to do so?
Yeah, come find me on LinkedIn. I love to geek out in this space. You know, as you can see, I'm hyper creative. So for me, I love this concept of bringing back play and creativity back into work. And again, all of the work we're talking about, it's like, how do we create more freedom? How do we create more, you know, ability to be free and creative? And so I think more creative thinking in how we build businesses versus just this analytical, we need both. But like, I think we need a bit of a leaning in, especially with the balance of AI coming in to do with the critical thinking potentially.
Yeah.
More creativity. So that's where we're going to really thrive.
Yeah. I love it.
Come find me. Come chat. I love this stuff.
It's a great call to action. Well, thanks for your time today, Nicole. It's been
no
a
worries.
Blast.
Thanks for having me. Loved being here.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,